Welcome back to Intelligent Medicine. Today, it's Q&A with Layla. It's an opportunity for us to answer your questions about medicine and nutrition. And we are continuing on the subject of coconut oil. That's what our next listener wants to know about, right, Layla?
Yes, yes. Hi, Dr. Hoffman. How are you? Can you enlighten me on this article, please? Bring some doubt into my mind. And this article is actually from a Dr. Meschino.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm pronouncing his name correctly. Meschino, apostrophe S. And the title of the article is coconut oil.
Does he do robotic surgery, Dr. Meschino? That's a good name. I don't know. Whatever.
Yeah. Coconut oil, an overrated and potentially dangerous source of fat.
Now, oh, wow. There we go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I glanced over this, Dr. Hoffman, and I have a big problem. He's quoting two articles. One is from October of 1987,
mm-hmm.
which is when people were still saturated fat phobic.
Mm-hmm.
And also...
That was a Duran Duran era, I think, right?
Something like... Yeah. Well,
right. Something like that.
I think so.
Yeah.
Anyway,
so that's like very old. Who was president in 1987? Was it Carter or Reagan? Or I don't even know. It was like, that gives us a perspective on, and let's see, 1987, I was about 30 and change. Mm-hmm. I'd just begun practice. And that was the prevailing view that saturated fats were bad. We were absolutely convinced that polyunsaturated fats were good. In fact, people were drinking. They were taking shots of Mazola corn oil because they believed polyunsaturated fats were good, and all saturated fats were bad. And that's when the Center for Science and Public Interest, along with there was a billionaire named Sokoloff, I think,
mm-hmm.
And he launched a campaign against tropical oils in foods as food additives. So instead, what they said, well, okay, we get rid of the tropical oils, and even cheaper are the trans fats, the margarine-like fats that now we realize is so dangerous. So inadvertently, he actually probably killed off a lot of people by urging them to get rid of the coconut oil,
mm-hmm.
and the palm oil. These are saturated fats. He said those are very bad. So you go back to 1987, I got a problem with that.
Yeah,
but keep going.
Totally. So that right there discredits this article to me, and I think it's just, wake up and read the more current research on saturated fat and all the benefits of coconut oil.
Even
in the dietitian community, we already know that coconut oil is good stuff.
Right, so, and what are the bona fides of this doctor, because I never heard of him?
I don't know. This is just literally the article that I had printed up. I don't know that much about him. He does have a newsletter.
Okay.
Nothing else is really said about here. He talks about many, many health conditions. His website is machinohealth.com.
Mm-hmm.
And, his argument is that there's a lack of human clinical trials. But he's not quoting any of the research.
What do you mean there's a lack of human clinical trials? What about the experience of thousands of years of Pacific Islanders eating and using coconut?
Mm-hmm.
What about that?
Exactly.
Were they dropping like flies of heart disease? I mean, they looked like...
The lack of cholera, the lack of all kinds of bacterial diseases and infections and so forth.
Well, let's talk about the benefits of coconut oil because, let's stipulate that it's not that harmful, but why bother to go to the lengths of consuming coconut oil? I actually did an interview with a guy recently, a podcast on that subject a few months ago, but what's your take on that?
Coconut oil, first of all, is primarily a medium-chain triglyceride, an MCT oil, which means it's used directly for energy by the liver, has little to no impact on cholesterol levels, but more importantly, the lauric acid, caprylic acid, is known to be a candida fighter, number one, has small amounts of caprylic acid in coconut oil, but lauric acid, which confers its benefit by becoming monolaurin biochemically in the body, has very strong antiviral effects.
Mm-hmm.
And these are some of the benefits. And this is how you have to think that people in the South Pacific, as well as Indonesia, Thailand, Philippines, who use primarily coconut oil in their cooking, have lower rates of many bacterial infectious diseases. And so this is actually pertinent.
Right, and then there's the Alzheimer's connection too, right?
Yes, yes. Coconut oil puts any medium-chain triglyceride, but coconut oil in particular, because it's a healthy one, the unrefined form is what we're talking about, puts us into ketosis, which is a fat-burning metabolism, actually called lipolysis ketosis. And in Alzheimer's, also known as type 3 diabetes or insulin resistance of the brain, where really the brain is getting cooked on too much blood sugar, it's helpful to switch over to a fatty acid burning metabolism. So being in ketosis is very, very helpful. And what the MCTs like coconut oil do is switch that on immediately upon consumption into a lipolysis ketosis metabolism.
So it's like a body-ready fuel, or actually, in this case, a brain-ready fuel that immediately fuels the metabolism of the mitochondria within the brain, rather than an unreliable source of energy that fluctuates, that goes up and down like blood sugar.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So, and there actually are studies now looking at MCTs and coconut oil as a way of forestalling Alzheimer's disease. There's actually some medical food studies looking at that particular prospect, and these types of oils are sold as medical foods to slow the progression towards dementia.
The other thing is the saturated fats are more heat stable for heat cooking, so it's better. You know, if you were ever going to French a fry, and we don't want you to eat French fries.
Right.
Cooking them in coconut oil at the very least, or do them in the oven, just toss them around a little bit and oven fry them, if you will. But the saturated fats are much more stable, much less volatile than any of the vegetable oils, which American Heart is still touting, and even a better source than olive oil. We're not supposed to cook with olive oil for long periods of time or with a lot of high heat.
Yeah, their molecular bonds are more resistant to the effects of heat. Oils that are polyunsaturated have they're heat unstable. So, you know, you generally don't want to cook at high temperatures with those oils because they will alter chemically and break down into harmful byproducts. Whereas saturated fats can get up to very high temperatures, and they're stable. It's just in their chemical backbone is less liable to be disrupted by the effects of a high-energy cooking.
Mm.
All right, exactly. So Dr. Machino, I don't think, knows too much about this. Maybe we should run him a letter.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. So that's what we think of that article.
Right.
That comes from Dimitri. Okay.
Yeah, you know, and unfortunately, there's a lot of...
There's a lot of misinformation.
A lot of misinformation, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, just lately, I mean, I'm just looking at this one. This is a listener called my attention to this one. That is in, you know, it's in the Harvard Health Letter, I think. And the pitch is, this Harvard researcher wants you to know that your supplements can kill you. And when you read it, it's actually a sensationalistic article. It's actually not, I'm sorry, it's not in the Harvard Health Letter. It's a website called Vox.com. This Harvard researcher wants you to know that your supplements can kill you. Okay. Well, first of all, it's not written by a Harvard researcher. It's written by a health writer, so it's a rather sensationalistic article. But actually,
so
if you read it...
It's a bait and switch right there. It's a bait and... I mean, it's a blatant lie.
No, but here's what's dishonest about this article. What the article...
Besides that it's not by a Harvard researcher, you mean?
Well, number one. Yeah, right. But even worse, what they're talking about is a substance called DMBA, and... It is a man-made version of the chemical DMAA, which is actually, it's been taken off the market by the FDA. It was used as a sports supplement, and I've never used it in a patient. And I guess there's some pitch that this can enhance your athletic performance or energy or something. But anyway, the people got sick from it, and that finally moved the FDA to get DMAA off the market. Okay, fine. So that's... Okay, granted, but does that taint the entire supplement industry? I mean, just as there are many drugs, I can barely, you know, recall how many dozen drugs have been taken off the market in the past decade or so, and does that mean that all pharmaceutical drugs are bad and that we should never take them? No, it doesn't. That doesn't follow logically. But they use this argument, and then they recite the mantra. The mantra is... And this is the Harvard researcher, his name is Dr. Cohen. He says, Dr. Cohen is a critic of the way the Food and Drug Administration regulates supplements and said consumers need to be on alert since the labels on their pill bottles might not tell them the full truth about what they're putting in their bodies. They said that supplement manufacturers are not required to prove their products actually do what they're marketed to. And, you know, there's no organized approach to collecting information about the adverse effects related to supplements, which is not true, which is not true.
That's true.
And so basically, this is a dishonest article, but it's out there. It's sensationalistic. And I think it's going to poison the well for at least some, you know, less informed individuals who don't take a balanced approach to their information gathering about supplements.
Yeah, it's a shame. Everybody, you know, there's a joke going around that everything you read on the internet is true.
Right.
Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah. including the Onion. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And you know, we do have a lot of people calling or asking or even coming in. Patients say, "Well, I read this on the internet about this and that about." You have to decide who you're going to put your trust into. That's really the bottom line. And we, Dr. Hoffman and I, as scientists, know how to vet what we're looking at, what we're reading, how to scrutinize it, and so forth. We have the ability, the training to do so.
I mean, how many times during the week,
I'm
sorry, but how many times during the week do I rush into your office and show you something and I'd say, what do you think of this? And we have to evaluate it. It's a new study one way or the other. And, you know, we carefully, you know, investigate it. Is there some truth to this? And, you know, sometimes it's damage control about a negative report. Sometimes it's something that sounds too good to be true about a supplement. You know, conversely, maybe it's too enthusiastic about a supplement. We have to take a critical view towards everything, both anti-supplement propaganda and sometimes over-the-top pro-supplement claims.
Yeah.
And then, you know, really have to see, you know, what is the research? Let's actually read the paper. Let's not just read the headlines. Let's go to the original research and see if what's the real deal. Instead of, you know, just headline reading. And the average person doesn't have the time or sophistication to go beyond these glaring headlines. So the headline, the impression you're left with is, you know, that these supplements, all supplements are harmful and dangerous. There's no regulation. It's a free fire zone. All right. Anyway, going to get off my soapbox and let you ask the next question.
Okay. Our next question is from Dennis. This is about osteoporosis. Do you think progesterone creams, prescription or non-prescription, are effective against osteoporosis? And do you believe any traditional Chinese medicine formulas work for osteoporosis? And is acupuncture on the kidney or on the spleen meridian useful for the disorder? Dr. Hoffman, didn't you study acupuncture at one time?
I did. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I did. I went to the Tri-State School of Traditional Chinese Medicine. I got a degree in traditional Chinese medicine. And, you know, so I have a lot of familiarity with acupuncture. I don't practice it anymore, and I know about traditional Chinese herbs to a certain extent. Although, you know, I got to say that the people who are proficient at this have been doing it for their entire lives. They have decades of experience, and I don't. So the answer, in my opinion, is that acupuncture doesn't do much for osteoporosis. Traditional Chinese herbs probably don't do much for osteoposis. And what was the other one, the first thing?
Progesterone cream.
Oh, yeah.
Prescription or not?
Yeah, I think the progesterone cream it's exaggerated in its benefits for osteoporosis. I think there may be some, but slight benefits. Dr. Lee was a big enthusiast.
He's a physician who talked about estrogen dominance.
Right. He was a real natural progesterone enthusiast and believed that it was almost a panacea. And it is beneficial for a lot of conditions, but I don't really believe that it can help with the symptoms of menopause, but I don't think it helps bone very much.
Okay. All right, Dennis. Hopefully, we'll talk about we get questions about osteoporosis and a lot. Let's just do a quick rundown of what's important. Getting DHEA levels checked, strontium is beneficial,
right.
Ostera, osteo support. Getting your vitamin D levels checked, vitamin K, as in MK7, magnesium levels. Also, adjunctive nutrients would be things like the others, omega-3s, potassium.
Silica, boron.
Diet. Boron,
right.
Yes.
Lysine is thought to be helpful. Iproflavone is in our osteosupport formula, and that's an agent that can help. Some studies suggest that soy may be beneficial. Alcohol actually turns out, a little bit of alcohol turns out to be somewhat helpful, not harmful, but of course too much
because
makes
of
you...
Because it's estrogenic.
Right, but too much will make you fall down and break your hip.
There you go.
Right. I was stone cold sober when I had my bicycle accident, I guarantee you.
That was a long time ago, right?
2006. Yeah.
2006, wow.
Time flies.
Wow. Okay, our next question is from Susan. Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I have a colonoscopy coming up. The instructions say to drink 64 ounces of Gatorade with a laxative. Oh, my goodness.
That's nuts.
That is nuts. And then she says, diet soda is an option for diabetics. I have severe hypoglycemia reactions mm-hmm. to even diet soda.
Yeah.
What do you recommend as a safe way to replenish the electrolytes? Get the laxative drink down without gagging?
Okay, well, here's the deal. Here's the deal. You know, the reason they say Gatorade is because it's handy, and it does contain electrolytes. And when you take a laxative like that, all the fluids run out of you, and you do become dehydrated, and you also lose a lot of potassium and magnesium and sodium and, you know, all the minerals.
Why are they suggesting Gatorade
well,
when it used
it's just
to be
handy.
Something called Go Lightly?
It's just handy. And then they have prescription Go Lightly, and I don't actually know precisely the ingredients of that. I'm not sure that that's better. I think we could... develop a kind of a workaround product for our patients anyway, where sometimes, you know, when we suggest patients rehydrate, we suggest a cleaner formula with buffered minerals. What's the product called? Trisalts. So we could actually create a little healthier mixture, you know, maybe just a little bit of natural juice for flavoring and, you know, add water and put in trisalts. And I think that that would be a preferable alternative. And they can make a big jug of that and drink it through the day. And I think that they'll be fine. I mean, take Gatorade and, you know, I mean, some of that stuff, it actually looks like it's fluorescent. I mean, those colors are so,
it is.
I mean, like the crazy red. I mean, colors that you don't find
yellow.
In nature. They're like magic marker colors, you know, so synthetic.
Mm-hmm.
Horrible dye ingredients.
They glow. Yeah.
Yeah, right. So... I mean, you know, I guess, I mean, look, once is not going to kill you, right? You know,
But Susan, hang in there, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know.
And then get a good meal afterwards.
Yeah, they're preferable alternatives to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. We have time for one short one. Do we have a short question that we can answer?
We have a short one from Harriet. On a recent podcast, it was stated by Dr. H that probiotics are best taken with food because stomach acid. But Dr. O'Hara's probiotics, am I saying it right? Is it O'Hara or O'Hara?
O'Hara.
O'Hara. Specifically state they're to be taken without food.
Well, you know, I've talked to them, and they've said, in their opinion, different.
So let's clear it up, yeah.
Yeah. I don't think there's a defined answer. I've read, you know, some studies. They're not really been that thoroughly studied, but some people take the position that you want to take your probiotics unadulterated, that you don't want them to be interfered with food. And that's the case with certain supplements where food can interfere with absorption. But I take the position that, you know, actually, you know, your stomach acid can inhibit the growth of certain bacteria. Your stomach is actually sterile. You know, there's no... generally, unless you have a severe gastrointestinal ailment, your stomach is sterile. And part of that is because it's very low pH. It's very acidic in the stomach. So it would stand to reason to me that if you're going to take your probiotic, you want to take it with food. Food has the effect of buffering the acidity because you add the food, which is a neutral composition to the acid, and you actually get a little bit of an attenuation of the acidity. And that may help the probiotic survive its transit through the stomach and make its way to the small intestine and the large intestine where it's going to do its job. So, and when I told the folks at Dr. Hear about this, they said it's perfectly all right. And, you know, I just think that, you know, some flexibility is in order on that.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot we don't know about probiotics. I think we need to do more studies about, you know, precisely that. What's the best time to take them? How much to take? How frequently? Does the colony count? Is that important? Should it be probiotics that whose growth is supported by milk products? Are there prebiotics like FOS that help to sustain the growth of probiotics? You know, which, I mean, some formulas contain, you know, 10 or 15 different species. And, you know, is it better to take a mixed formula or one thing at a time? And, you know, for certain conditions, do you take something, yeah. Say, if you have frequent vaginitis or urinary tract infections, you take something else to support your immunity? Do you take something else if you have ulcerative colitis? Do you take something else if you have irritable bowel or constipation? If you take something else to help you lose weight, because we know that the bacterial composition of your intestine affects your metabolism, and so on and so on. These are all unresolved questions, and they're being thoroughly researched, but we have not yet arrived at definitive answers. So,
yeah.
So it ain't rocket science yet.
Right. And at the end of the day, we always have more questions than we do answers, so we just keep plugging away.
But, hey, we live in exciting times. Isn't it exciting to be a nutritionally-oriented practitioner? Because the developments are coming fast and furious. We can barely keep up with them. And I love reading and studying, and I know you do, too. You know, spend a lot of time in your office reviewing the latest studies, so you can pass on the latest, most accurate information to your patients. And it's constantly evolving and changing.
Yes.
So that's what we're all about.
That's how we know coconut oil is good for us.
Yeah, right. I actually read something since 1987. Occasionally I, stop watching sports on TV and I actually read a scientific paper, So, all right, great. All right, so I think that is about as much time as we have for today's edition of Q&A with Layla. We'll save some additional questions for next week. And if you have a question, please send it to radioprogram@AOL.com, one word, radioprogram@AOL.com, and we'll endeavor to answer it. It may take a couple of weeks before we catch up to your question, so please be patient. Listen to each and every edition of Q&A with Layla. Also, check out our recent podcasts. I did a recent podcast with a clinical focus on the subject of immunity, and what prompted me to do that is that we are all about Ebola these days. Everybody is in a dither about the prospects for Ebola to spread. And it would be facile for me to say that, you could just take a certain vitamins, take some vitamin D and probiotics, and, it'll be a perfect bulwark against Ebola. But we do know that resistance plays a role in whether you're likely to come down with an infection. There's also other things going around. There's this enterovirus D68. Which is a terrible scourge, particularly among kids. And, so we want to, study more about how to naturally support our immunity, especially since there's no conventional mainstream magic bullet to eradicate these diseases. So check out that Clinical Focus podcast. Also, a recent interview I did with Dr. Thomas Williams on the subject of folic acid. That's something we're all over these days, MTHFR, and its implications for whether we should take specialized, more easily metabolized form of folate. There's a whole debate about that. Is folic acid obsolete? We take that up in one of our recent podcasts. So please, in addition to listening to our radio show on the weekend, which is live on WOR and many other stations across the country on Saturdays usually, please take the time to listen to some of our podcasts, which hopefully deal with questions that you want to hear answers for. So thanks very much for joining us, Layla.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman.
And I'll see you in the office in probably just a few hours.
Okay.
All right. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Thanks for joining us.